This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Please note, this episode contains discussion around suicide and it may not be suitable for all listeners. Hello and welcome to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. It's the podcast where I sit down with an extraordinary person and they share their story. They might have overcome adversity, they might still be on their journey with stories that will make you laugh, cry, and hopefully feel a little bit inspired. Today, I'm joined by an author, mother, and presenter who's never held back when speaking about some of the most challenging times of her life. Dawna Porter has always had questions to ask, and in the past has fronted TV documentaries investigating subjects such as childbirth, polygamy, size zero, and breast cancer. Dawn has more recently been immersing herself in writing critically acclaimed books, releasing novel The Cows in 2016 and So Lucky in 2019, and last year released her first non-fiction book, Life in Pieces. Not afraid to say how it really is, Dawn talks frankly about her life in lockdown, reflecting on everything from parenting and sleep to identity and grief. With the paperback of the book releasing yesterday, I'm thrilled to be catching up with Dawn to see how those pieces of life are doing now. Welcome to the podcast, Dawn.
Thank you. That was such a nice introduction.
Well, I was going to start by saying welcome home because you're back from LA. Is this home or is LA home?
To be honest with you, whichever one I'm in feels like home. And I've lived there for 12 years now. I don't ever seem to long for the other one when I'm in the other one, which is lovely. But after such a traumatic year and a half of being stuck on the other side of the world, this really, really feels like home right now. Just London feels the familiarity, the fact that you can walk around and probably bump into someone that you know is just so lovely. Just the architecture, everything about it, London in the summertime, even though it hasn't stopped raining, but that vibe of people kind of being out and about. So I feel very settled after, like everyone, such a long time of just feeling like, what the hell is happening?
Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it? I guess we all found that wherever you live, it is about the friendships and the sort of network that you create around you.
Yeah.
But I did at the moment where I was like, it's a really good time to be a parent. Like, I feel so lucky that I've got kids.
I do agree with that. I think obviously there's days where it didn't feel that way. I would kind of fantasize about my pre-kids life and just think about how productive I would have been, you know, how fit I would have been, how all of these things that you presume you'll do. But the reality is not many of my friends who don't have kids were actually doing that. No, mm-hmm. It was actually, motivation was the hardest part of the year, wasn't it? To actually make yourself do something.
It was so intense. I mean, you've talked a lot about motherhood. Is it something as a woman that was always on your radar? How did it come about that you became a parent of your two boys?
I don't think it was really. I wasn't one of those girls or 20-year-olds or even early 30-year-olds. I met Chris on my 30th birthday. So it kind of, that decade was quite defined by that relationship. But I definitely wasn't on a mission to find the father of my children throughout my 20s. I was always presumed that I would be the single one in my 40s. And if I wanted to, I would find a way to have a baby, and that would be like some exciting journey that I went on. I would just have lots of cats. That's how I saw my future. I just wasn't broody at all. And then married Chris when I was 34. And I just remember waking up when I turned 35, it was like my uterus was just like, fill me.
Yeah.
And it was this new feeling that I just could not ignore. Really, really wanted to have a baby. And I really just followed my gut on that. And I do wonder if I hadn't have met Chris, if I ever would have had that feeling. Because I really feel like I wanted him to be. I saw us as a family, and that whole picture suddenly made it, you know, what I wanted. I think one of the hardest demographics for this lockdown was so many of my friends who were like, you know, 39 turning 40, who thought this was the year that they were going to meet someone and have a baby, and they just feel that they've been robbed of that time. Yeah. And I really feel for them, because it's just an incredibly hard situation to be in. So you know, you can never guess what your life would have been like, but I do think like meeting Chris was like a sliding door situation, and if I hadn't have met him, I wonder what that other life would have been like. And I think it probably would have been single with lots of cats.
Yeah. Oh God. It's difficult, isn't it? Because you can romanticize it and look at it all with rose tinted spectacles. Because I know I spent a lot of time reflecting like that and thinking of those things. And I think also in my relationship, our roles changed, because I used to always be out on the road, always working. And actually I became a lot more hands-on with the kids, a lot more domestic. I mean, it's slowly going back again in the other way. What about you and Chris? Do you play different roles? Do you have different approaches to parenting? Or
Chris is quite a lot more organized than I am. So he would do a schedule. So I've got the kids till 11, you've got them till 2, and do that. Which worked really well, because to be honest with you, that's the only reason I got to write that book, is because when I would get like 4 hours off the kids every day, because he would take them. We're quite traditional in our roles, despite being quite a feminist family. Like I do all of the cooking, because it is literally one of my favorite things to do. And I really enjoy that role when Chris does like the putting up shelves and all the tech stuff. So we're quite like man, woman in that way. In terms of childcare, that's something that we just split and we just both do. I'm a bit more chaotic, quite like the chaos.
I'm like that.
Thrive
off the chaos, I do.
Kind of. Yeah. I feel like organization is nice when it's working, but it's the stress of having to maintain it isn't what my personality is good with. So almost too much organization just stresses me out, because I'm so scared of failing and ruining it.
So what about your own childhood? You know, it's interesting there hearing about, you know, how you and Chris parent. What was your own childhood like?
Oh gosh, that's a large question. My own childhood. Well, I was born in Scotland. Let's start at the start. And when I was around one, my parents got divorced and my mum moved with my sister and I down to Guernsey, where her family was. And we lived with our grandparents, which was, I mean, I remember it. Obviously, I was only lived there till I was quite young, but it was probably strange that we lived with our grandparents and our mum. That wasn't kind of a usual situation so I can't remember any of my other friends living in that situation. My dad, I didn't see him very much. We'd go up to Scotland for the odd holiday, but I always adored him and loved him. I've always gotten very well with him. And then when my mum was very ill, she had breast cancer, which I wasn't hugely aware of. She used to go to the UK and send postcards from castles. Like she was just on holiday, but actually she was in Southampton Hospital getting treatment. And I have odd memories. Like I remember one time being in the kitchen with her. I must have been really young, probably about 6. And she would just be crying her eyes out. And then I remember one time she said, I'll come into the garden and I'll read your story. And we laid on this sun lounger and she read me Jack and the Beanstalk. And I just remember, it's so odd because you remember so little from that age. You just have these kind of flashes, but that one stuck with me. And I think it stuck with me because years later I realised that was probably when she just found out that her cancer wasn't going to go away.
Right.
And she died a couple of days before my 7th birthday. And I remember that time as just that's all a real blur. I remember the night I was told, when my aunt and uncle told us, and I just thought my uncle was joking and I told him to stop being so silly, and this kind of denial that I think remained with me for a very long time. And then when I was around 10, my grandparents were getting very old. And so my aunt and uncle, my mum's brother and his wife, took us in, me and my sister. And so they became our parents, really. And we lived with them from the age of 10. My dad, still up in Scotland, I have three parents who we'd go and visit. And so we moved in with them. And, you know, they were older. They'd already had their kids who had left home. And suddenly they've got these two traumatized young girls living with them. So I don't want to underestimate how hard that was for them. There were definitely some really difficult times where everyone realized how fucking awful this was. And there were also some really amazing times with huge, you know, Sunday roasts with all friends coming over in this kind of environment that wasn't really what my grandparents' house was like. And so it did loads of wonderful things for me and my sister, but I definitely remember feeling like I knew I was different from the other kids. I knew I was living in somebody else's house and that my behaviour mattered, and that everything was slightly, nothing was ever for sure, which isn't my aunt and uncle's fault. But that's, of course, when you go and live in somebody else's house when you're 10, you're aware that you've been moved because either somebody else couldn't cope or because it wasn't working out. And there's always a sense of I'm different. I always knew I was different, which I quite liked and I quite used to my advantage, and knew that there's a book, Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit by Jeanette Winterson. And one of the lines on the first page was, there was never a time that I didn't know that I was special. Mm-hmm. And that book resonated with me when I was a kid, not special in wonderful terms. I mean, special as in, I know that I'm different and I know that that's either something that can be a negative or a positive in my life. And I remember quite early on, quite enjoying the fact that I was different. But look, I'm an exhibitionist by nature. I, you know, wanted to be on the stage, jazz hands and naming lights. So as this kind of young girl on Guernsey, like I described myself as a young Moana staring on the beach, like, what is beyond the roof? And just kind of desperate to get to the mainland and start living my life.
It's amazing because I feel like not many people would know this about you, and the way you're able to talk about it. You just seem like such a resilient person. I think, you know, one of the things in all of your writing is you're always very honest. You know, in your book, Life in Pieces, you talk about losing your friend, Caroline Flack, which obviously happened at the start of lockdown. None of us knew we were going to go into lockdown, and you went into it with that grief. I think, you know, when we get to our age, I'm 37, we do lose grandparents and that's really sad. And I think we're able to cope, but I don't think at this age we expect to start losing friends.
No.
And I don't know if you'd agree. Does that feel like a different type of grief?
Oh, I mean, it's, you know, when I talk about grief in terms of my mum, I was so young. It's not grief. It was something was snatched away from you and you're left with this like hole that you don't know how to fill. And it's an eerie kind of feeling, but I don't grieve my mum because honestly, and it's awful, I don't remember her very well. So it's not that kind of loss. When Caroline died, I mean, I can say, like, you know, as an adult, it's the worst thing that's ever happened to me. I was just, the shock of it was so hideous. I mean, I loved Caroline. She thrilled me as a human. Like, I found her the funniest person in the world. She was the most loyal friend to me. I would actually, when I knew she was coming into a room, my heart would start racing. I would tingle. I was so excited to see her every time I saw her, and we just had an absolute ball. She was, I can't even say believe I'm saying was. Her energy is still everywhere as far as I'm concerned. When she died, it was like someone just pulled the plug on one of the most things that made me happiest. It was just the saddest thing, the shock. Obviously, when someone dies of suicide, you're left with a lot of, could I have done more? Should I have said something? And over time, you realise that, no, that's not the case. When someone's in that state, there's nothing that you can do. Or maybe there is, but there was nothing that I could have done from the other side of the world. So that grief is something people have always talked to me like I understand grief. When people, you know, friends, mothers have died, they've kind of come to me as if I can help them. I'm like, guys, what you're going through as a 20 plus year old losing a parent is, I don't know that feeling. I was a child. I was like, it was buried. That's not how I feel. So Caroline was my first actually, that's not fair. We've lost family members on Chris's side, and that was there. But Caroline was the closest person to me that's died as an adult. I think I look back and I go, did I cope well? How did I deal with that? I don't know. I don't know what coping well is. I mean, it's very weird because there were 6 weeks of absolute hell while I was in LA after I received the news before the funeral. I can only describe that as that I was just wading through mud. I was just wading through mud. I was.
How did you find out?
My friend Josie called me. I will always be grateful for the way that I found out, because the 8-hour time difference means that I could have just woken up and seen it on Twitter.
Right.
But by some stroke of luck, I woke up. I had a text from my friend Josie saying I needed to call her, and I knew it was something. My heart sunk. I was like, this isn't going to be good. And I called her, and I had just about enough time. I remember sitting, I was in the bedroom, Chris was with the kids, and they were all laughing. They're having such a good morning. And I just sent Chris a text and I said, can you just put the kids in front of the TV and just come in here? I've just had a really bad call. And I feel like I've roared. And then I just started roaring. And then I had just about enough time to call two friends who I really wanted to hear it before, three friends actually, before it broke on Twitter. And as I was calling them, it couldn't believe it. It was so weird. I felt like only a few of us knew, but people started to say it on Twitter so quickly. It was so terrifying how that machine kicks in.
And were you aware of her mental health? Because, you know, we've seen lots of different people losing people through suicide this year, and many of us have been totally unaware of where they were at in their lives with their mental health.
But I knew she was in a bad way, but I didn't know it was that bad.
Mm.
I wasn't expecting that call. We'd been in touch that week and I knew things were bad, but I wasn't there. I was, you know, I was in LA and she was in London. So I was, I wasn't getting those details from her on text.
Mm.
But I knew she was checking in with her all the time. So I knew she was going through something absolutely horrific, but I didn't think it was going to come to that. I had a whole plan for her. I was like, this is what you're going to do. You're going to be fine. You're going to do this work on yourself. You're going to get the help you need. You're going to feel the support and the love of the people around you. And you're going to just, you know, sit back for a while until you feel stronger. And then you're going to get through this and everything's going to be fine. Because weirdly, and this is the thing about mental health, is that these are incredibly resilient people.
Mm-hmm.
Who feel this way.
Mm.
And this understanding where I think telling Caroline's story and what her mom and sister really wanted to do with the documentary that they made is just make sure that people understand that people can be more than one thing, and that she was, all of the brilliant stuff that I described earlier is absolutely who Caroline was. None of that was an act and her hiding this other thing, but sometimes this other side to her, the voices became louder. And it's very difficult to, like, get into that side of somebody. It's not something they're proud of and they want to share. And this is why the conversation around mental health is so important, to try and give people who feel that way the confidence and the security to be able to admit to those feelings. Because part of it, I'm sure, is the fact that you just feel so desperately alone and ashamed for having mm-hmm. those thoughts. And actually, you know, as somebody who is close to you or close to her, she'd have opened up about that. I mean, there were people, I'm sure, that, you know, were more aware, who were closer to her, who did know about it. But if someone speaks to you that tells you that they're feeling that way, the level of support you're going to get if you open up and admit it is huge. But anyway, I think that's just why the conversation is so important. And you know, this thing, if, like, the people listening to this podcast, I'm sure, that have felt that way or feel that way very often, feel alone.
Mm.
And when you've lost someone in that way, you just want to say to them, God, the last thing you are is alone. Like, you are so not alone. We're here for you. But trying to build that confidence to be able to say those things out loud must be so hard. So back to your original question anyway, what was lockdown like? So we went to the funeral. We all gave each other coronavirus at the funeral. So we had that right at the start, which was terrible.
Handing,
anyway, I was on one of the last flights back, heading back to LA after when they were saying everything was shutting down. Trump had just announced the borders were closing the next day. Very, very surreal. Very, very surreal experience being on the airplane that day. But I got home and I just remember thinking, I don't want to go out. I can't see people. My world has just come to an absolute grinding halt. That's the only way I could describe it. I don't know how to continue without Caroline. And I need the world to stop turning. And then look what happened. So in one way, that first, I'd say 6 months of lockdown, I was really grateful for it because I couldn't imagine how I could have, I needed that time. I wasn't able to go and live my normal life and be normal and happy. It was an amazing thing to be able to have that time to just grieve, but also basically be Mary Poppins at the same time and have to look after the kids. So like the kind of contrast in the two personalities that I was living was, I mean, it was, which is why the book, I had to write the book because I have to keep this daily diary of this kind of up and down. One minute I am literally hiding in a cupboard. I had this wardrobe that I could walk into, and I used to sit on the little red stool in there and just sob so my kids didn't see me. And then the next minute I'm, you know, trying to bake a cake, which I'm awful at, or making something out of Play-Doh. I'm like, what is that? This is the weirdest experience. Yeah. But somehow managing to do all of that over the course of a day.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
You may have heard of the podcast Juicy Scoop. Wondered what it is? Why aren't you listening? Well, I'm its host, created it, been doing it for 7 years. I'm Heather McDonald of Juicy Scoop with Heather McDonald. Now, I could tell you why you should be listening to my show, but my listeners wanted to write the ad for me, and here are some of the things they said. Not your regular Juicy podcast. Catch up on all the juicy topics from Hollywood and pop culture to true crime and beyond. Heather McDonald's Juicy Scoop always has great guests, great laughs, and great gossip. It's a comedian's take on the hottest headlines. Juicy Scoop is the pop culture news you want to hear. No BS, no filter, no filler. Raw, real, and in the moment. Throw in the hilarity of amazing comedians that you will instantly be obsessed with, a juicy crime story, and a dash of normal life in LA moments, and you've got yourself an amazing week of Juicy Scoop. Two episodes every week, every Tuesday and Thursday. It will never let you down.
You did something really beautiful in March, and I wondered if it was because of everything you were going through with your grieving. You know, we all were talking about being kind, and you have a charity, Choose Love, and you quit Twitter and you donated your Twitter to the charity so that they could use that platform for good.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some obvious reasons why you would do that. It's an amazing thing to do for a charity. It's a great database for a charity. But I felt like there was some real sort of, maybe you'd gone on this journey of what mattered and what didn't and what negativity you didn't want in your life. Talk to me a bit about that, because I felt quite overwhelmed by it. I thought it was a pretty cool thing to do.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I, not to get into the details of talking about Caroline, but I definitely feel like Twitter suddenly felt like a very toxic place. You know, it was had a lot to say about her. And then after she died, it became a very sympathetic place. And I was like, you know what? I don't really trust this. I've always had a really good relationship with social media. I do have to say, you know, the odd troll, but nothing terrible at all. I feel very lucky. But I did just suddenly look at it and like, what approval am I looking for from everybody? Why does it make me feel so awful when out of, you know, all of those hundreds of thousands of people, one person says something mean and they're the person that I go to bed thinking about that night when they've got like 5 followers and who even are they? It's probably a fake name. And I just got stunned and looked at the whole thing. It's like, God, this is a weird position that we're putting ourselves in. And also I couldn't keep reading sympathy at that time because I don't know if I believed that it was real immediately afterwards. I do believe it's real now. And I think people had a real shock and that all of that is very real. But at the time I was like too much too soon type feeling. And so I just quit Twitter. So I thought, right, I'm going to take a break. And then I thought Choose Love means the absolute world to me. And it meant a lot to Caroline. Josie, who runs Choose Love, is mine and Caroline's best friend. And I just thought, how could I, rather than just shut it down and just waste that thing, I'm just going to give it to them. And it was just immediately, I was sitting on the sofa with Josie when I was back for the funeral. And I just said, right, sign me out, change my password. I don't want anything to do with it. Just do it. She was like, are you sure? And I was like, yes, just do it. And as soon as I did it, I was like, I built that following for a really good thing. And it's just gone to a brilliant cause. I would recommend to anybody actually who's got a big following on Twitter, who is just not feeling like it's their place anymore. Don't just shut it down and waste it. Give it to someone who, you know, could use it, like give it to a charity, or give it to, if there's a new author who's got like 5 followers whose book you really loved, give it to them. Like, just, you know, share the kind of the audience, because I think it's just a really lovely, fun thing to do, or sell it in an auction.
I'm sat here now thinking I should donate mine. You're inspiring me to kind of shed the layers.
So we feel good.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. It has become really toxic, and it's just not needed in life. We should talk about Choose Love, though, because it's an amazing charity. It was formerly known as Help Refugees, and it was 2015 that you set it up. Is that right?
Yeah, it would have been, yeah.
So how did it come about, and how did you first start fundraising? Because that's a big thing to take on and set
I mean,
up.
We didn't know it was going to be this. So I had just had my first baby, and I was over from LA, sitting having lunch with Josie, who I was talking about before, and saying, why aren't more people talking about what's happening in Calais? Why aren't people helping? Like, it's awful. And so over the course of this like boozy Sunday lunch, we just decided that we would do something. So our friend Leanna Bird was quite knowledgeable about it all. So the three of us got together and thought, right, let's aim. I think this was in probably around August. Let's aim at the end of September to send a lorry load of supplies to Calais. And that was it. That was all we were going to do. Didn't have a lorry. Didn't know how we were going to do this. Didn't have any details on anything. And just through my Twitter feed started to appeal for donations. And we set up, I think it was Leanna who had the brilliant idea of doing an Amazon wish list where you say what's needed. And so people just order it and they don't have to do anything more than just pay
That's
for
a
it.
Good
and
idea.
It all comes to us. Yeah. So easy. Anyway, we got like 7,000 packages delivered over the course of 24 hours. We're completely inundated. We didn't have any infrastructure, didn't know what we were doing. Then we started like, right, I'll give them a shout out, Big Yellow Storage, can you help us out? They gave us a floor basically at one of their storage units, and we just filled it immediately. Then we started appealing for volunteers from Instagram to come and help, and Twitter to come and help, because I remember like quite a few celebrities turned up to help, which was amazing. Suddenly we were like, okay, this is huge. Way more than a lorry. How the hell are we going to get this all to Calais? And so suddenly we then had to like ask companies to lend us lorries with drivers. Mm-hmm. And we're like, oh my God, what have we done? This is terrifying. It very quickly we came to realize that people really wanted to do something but didn't know how. And we had offered this this option of how to help. And we managed to get that stuff to Calais. In the end, a supermarket lend us a fleet of lorries to deliver stuff around Europe as well.
Does restore your faith in society, doesn't it?
It really did. It was a really amazing time. And very quickly we came. I just had a baby, and I'd also just launched my own business, a clothing brand, and I was about to move back to California. So we had this kind of crisis talk. Well, I remember standing in the lobby of some, I think it was a big lawyer's office, because we were like, we really need like advice and help. And Josie and Leanna and I stand and go, what do we do? Is this the end of the journey, or are we carrying on? And I said, I'm always here as, you know, to help in any way I can, but I can't take on the actual logistical running of a charity. And Josie at the time was an assistant for Coldplay. And she said, well, I will. And she quit her job in the glamorous rock world and became the head of this, and Leanna did it too. And they just built a team. They're the main source of aid for the refugee crisis across the world. I'm not going to take any credit for the day-to-day running of that charity, but I do everything I can in terms of fundraising. And I'm just, you know, shamelessly the person who has to kind of ask Harry Styles to be in our Christmas promo video and stuff like that, which is fun, but it's also excruciating. You must be on both sides, get asked to do stuff all the time, and have to ask people to do stuff. And I wish people understood when they see, because people can be really shitty about celebrities promoting charities. And here, I'm here to say this right now, the amount of money that it raises when someone is willing to put their name to it is so huge. So don't be pissed off with celebrities supporting charities. As someone who has a charity, we rely on it. We beg yeah. for it. When someone is willing to do it because they get asked to do so much stuff, it means the absolute world. Like the thank you letters that we send are like drooling with thanks yeah. because we're so grateful. When you see that a celebrity has popped up and said, support, choose love, like, don't give them a hard time. Like, please just say thank you. Because from those videos that we put together, from those, when we get someone to Instagram or tweet about Choose Love, we literally raise thousands of pounds for refugees off the back of those.
It's a no overhead way of fundraising, which is
otherwise we have to pay yeah. for advertising or get funding to pay for PR or whatever. And it's like, please, if you've ever thought, oh God, another celebrity promoting some charity for them, you know, for their own personal PR, it's really not. People like me have begged them and begged them and begged them, and they very kindly agreed to do it.
So can we go from celebrities, charities and refugees to weed gummies and alcohol?
Yes, please.
Because that was a great link.
Yeah, because
So Life in Pieces, like I said, it's really open, it's really honest. And that was one of the things you talked about in lockdown, weed yeah. gummies and alcohol. And I never know, when you research people and read stuff, you're like, is that true? Is that not true? Because obviously things get twisted in headlines.
Yeah.
Talk to me about it.
Well, so let me first talk about weed gummies, because just to like bowl over the controversy here, weed is legal in California. So firstly, okay. there's shops that are like Apple stores where you go in and buy whatever you want. So if anyone thinks that I'm breaking the law in any way, I'm not. I haven't ever taken a weed gummy in England because it's illegal here and I wouldn't know where to get them. So let's just clear that up first. But in terms of LA, I'm not massively into weed. I never smoked weed when I was at college. Didn't do anything for me. It just made me pass out and hated the smell of it. But since it's become legal, there's all these kind of fancy ways that you can take it, either in a little mint or a gummy. And it's a really, really low dose. For me, it's like 2.5 milligrams, I think it is. And if I was to compare it to, it's probably would give you the equivalent buzz of a glass of wine. Like I would have one of those. I'm not walking around my kids stoned out my face. It's just, and I actually,
there's the headline.
I know. And I really, really, really wasn't, I was quite drunk, but wasn't stoned. I haven't had a weed gummy in probably about 10 months, but in that period of time after Caroline died, when lockdown kicked in, they just took the edge off me feeling like absolute shit, if I'm honest with you. And I really believe in the medicinal qualities of marijuana, and that it will be, you know, something that is just so accepted and normal very soon all over the world. Because when you're talking about it in tiny doses like that, it just took the edge off. And so I had one most days in lockdown. And then in terms of booze, I would definitely say that I did definitely drink a lot in that first 6 months of lockdown. Partly because lockdown was so boring and it was fun. So if like at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, Chris and I were like, oh bugger it, should we just have a margarita? I mean, and it made those days that were exhausting and long and often quite sad and hard, just fun. I don't know about you. I actually put on 16 pounds over the course of lockdown.
Yeah.
And that was from, because I really turned to cooking and food as well, because that was really like, and also the fact that when I was cooking, I didn't have to be looking after the kids. So I was like, I'm going to cook another really indulgent meal. And got to around February of 2021 when we were actually in Toronto and was like, okay, 16 pounds heavier than I was this time last year. So then I really got on it and got really fit, quit drinking, started eating really healthily and got fit again. So kind of came out of lockdown as I went in, which was quite good. But there's this whole like, you know, 12, 13 months in the middle that were just this huge indulgent, like God, just stuffing my face, which was great.
I did the same. So we drank loads. We day drank. We had the heat wave here. We were in the garden barbecuing. And then I would eat all the beige foods hungover. I put on nearly 2 stone.
Did you?
Yeah. And then life came back and all my clothes of zips wouldn't zip up. So I was
just
like,
nothing fitted, yeah.
I was on Zoom with like all the zips undone because obviously no one could see. then real life in person returns. So I was like, okay, I got to get fit. Did the same as you, got fit, got into like more running, more cycling. And then another lockdown came in the winter and I put it all back on again. So I was like,
easily
it's been
done.
So long. Yeah. So now I'm back on, I've got a green juice today. I'm back on the health kick.
Oh, very good. I'm just trying now to be, because we just got back to London. I'm so happy to see everyone. We're going out for more dinners and stuff. I think it would be, you know, hard for me to put on another 16 pounds, but I'm so relaxed about it. And I'm just really, but I'm enjoying being healthier. I'm enjoying exercise for the first time ever. Also, I'm 42, just can't do that anymore. I used to, if I have an indulgent weekend now, I feel it in my body all week. When that never used to happen, you've just got to have to slightly change the way that you consume when you, after you've turned 40. I was quite shocked by that. Oh, look, my little pussycat in the background there.
Now, we must talk about the books out in paperback.
Yes.
And obviously, your previous books have been novels, and this is more of a memoir. Why did you decide to do that?
Can I be totally honest? Because our industry shut down and I needed the money in lockdown. And I was writing this blog every day. I have a subscription blog. Another thing that I did after around the time that Caroline died, I just wanted to protect myself online a bit. So I started a blog, but rather than just throw it out there into the ether of the internet, I charge $4 a month for my blog, which means that the only people that are there want to read my work. And I used to feel quite weird about that. But then I was like, hang on a minute, this is my job. Why do writers write for free all the time? It's absolutely stupid. So it's a very kind of lovely protected space where I was writing my daily diary, and I was a lot more open than I'd ever have been if I was doing Instagram updates or writing a, you know, public blog. I was like, is there a way that we can do this book, but I will edit out a lot of the really, really personal stuff about the kids and just make it more about me and my life and add essays and all that kind of stuff. And they were happy with that. So I was like, right, where do I sign? And suddenly I was writing essentially a memoir, which I never thought I would write. And if I did, then I was going to be, you know, 70 writing something like this. And I was nervous about it because it was personal, but also this feeling that we were all, the whole world was going through something very dramatic. We were all stuck at home with our families. We were all having to just, the sharing just became quite therapeutic. So if it hadn't been for lockdown, obviously it's a book about lockdown, but there's lots of essays from my life. I don't think I would have written a book of essays if it hadn't have been for being served that kind of bizarre situation. But I'm so glad I did now. It's actually really nice.
I was
going to
say, we're so lucky that you did. Yeah,
because
it's produced this.
Yeah, it felt really good to open up. And, you know, post-kids, I'm a lot more less cagey about kids now that they're older. I was very cagey when they were babies. I didn't want anyone talking about them at all.
Yeah, I get that, yeah.
But now it's like there's no secret that I have kids. So it felt like I didn't expose too much about them. They're not on Instagram. It's like we haven't done any of that stuff. It just felt quite nice to write about family life.
So does that mean the next book you'll continue to do this, or would the next book go back to a novel?
I'm about to sit down and start writing a novel. I think nonfiction is something that it will depend what's going on in the world. I don't feel like I've got anything to say right now. You know, who knows what the future brings and what experiences I'll go through, and that maybe I feel like that needs to go down on paper. Also, stuff like, I write for a living now. I don't do any TV. I'm a full-time writer, and you know, you get handed grief like that, or you get handed lockdown, and of course that's going to end up being what you write about. It's like you can't walk away from material when it is presented to you in that way. But at the moment, literally have no life material at all. I'm just writing a whole book about my cats. Got nothing
to
say.
I'd buy that. It's fine.
I think that's an idea. Mad cat woman. But you know, like I said, it's not, it would just depend on life. But I can't wait to write fiction again. There's, when you write fiction, you can put in so much about yourself but hide it. And I love that. Like there's a little piece of me in all my characters, but none of them, you know, in the last two that I've written, for sure, just I'm not writing about myself, which is great. But you always use yourself as inspiration, I think, when you write fiction.
Well, whatever you continue to write, please carry on being so honest and open, because you help so many people, including myself.
Oh, thank you, darling.
Yeah, I think it's one of the reasons I really admire you, and I suppose almost envy you, because I think the way you speak, it's, you don't care what people think of you, you know, and you talked about leaving Twitter because it was toxic. You know, you don't seem to write and have a headline in mind or worry. And I think that's a really amazing place to get to your life, where you're not appeasing other people and you're being authentic and being yourself. And I think a lot of us, that's our journey. Some of us want to get to that point. So it must be quite freeing.
It is lovely. Just not worrying about it. I also think back in the day when I wanted a TV career, you're so aware that everything could kind of get you to that. Once I stopped wanting to be on TV, like the world just kind of opened up. It was a lot freer because I wasn't trying to get employed. I'm not trying to get employed anymore, which is a huge relief. As long as I keep writing, I'll always have work. But when I'm trying to get a job, I think your output changes a bit. I also say, like, I from, because my mum died so young, you live a certain kind of life when you never have to worry what your mother would say. Mm-hmm. And it's that was what I lived like as a kid. And now as a grown up, you live a certain kind of life when you're not trying to impress employers. But that doesn't mean to say I say things that I don't say things that I don't regret. Like sometimes I'll go to bed and I'll just be like, or wake up in the morning, like, why was I on Instagram drunk? Why was I?
Yeah. I've been there. Yeah.
Delete. Why did I say that? That happens a lot.
Well, thank you so much for today. As expected, you've been extraordinary. And it's been an amazing chat that I'm sure a lot of people are going to relate to, and it's going to help a lot of other people. So thank you.
Thank you, Katie.
Thanks for listening to Katie Piper's Extraordinary People. If you haven't already, please follow where you get your podcasts. Also, if you enjoyed this, please help us spread the word. Rate and review the show or share on your socials.